Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 27th of November 2016. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Dead Funny at the Vaudeville Theatre. This is Terry Johnson's 1994 play, first done at the Hampstead Theatre. It's directed here by Terry Johnson, who also directed the first production, and indeed at one stage, I believe, appeared in it. I think somebody's got a story about that.
I have.
The cast is very television friendly. This is, after all, in the West End, so we have... The theatre website seems to have put them in order of cultural profile. So we have Catherine Parkinson as Eleanor, Steve Pemberton as Brian, Ralph Little as Nick, Emily Barrington as Lisa, and Rufus Jones as Richard. These characters were played in the first production by Zoe Wanamaker, Niall Buggy, Danny Webb, B.T. Edney and David Haig, respectively. The basic story here is that Eleanor wants a child. Her husband, Richard, would like to oblige, but he's not really that interested in her, or at least he pretends to be impotent. But he's also running a society about English comedy, a British comedy, called the Dead Funny Society. And we're introduced to three other members, who Brian, Nick and Lisa. And they are gathering because they've heard that Benny Hill has died. And they decide to have a party. This was done in 1994. Benny Hill died in 1992. And another death that occurred around the same time is Frankie Howard. So Frankie Howard also features in this play. And what we get at times is them reenacting a lot of famous old comedy routines from the likes of Frankie Howard or Benny Hill or indeed Morecambe and Wise. John, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
I think this is going to be quite an unusual Sunday for me because I'm in the position of actually being the one out of the three of us who most enjoyed this piece. And I enjoyed it for a couple of reasons. One is that I had a sense of personal nostalgia in that 20 years ago, about that sort of time, mid-90s time, there was a lot of this about light comedies filling the West End that chronicle the disintegration of a suburban marriage while simultaneously lampooning the middle-class enthusiasm for some hobby or other. You know, in the interest of citing examples, Millard, Akebourne certainly had multiple goes at it, didn't he? You know, the cabin cruising boat people and in Way Upstream and the members of an amateur choir in Chorus of Disapproval. But also this reminded me of Richard Harris skewering the village cricketers in Outside Edge or the way Michael Frayn crushed those obsessive salesmen with Leonard Rossiter in Make and Break, or even Simon Gray and his blinkered cloistered academics in Quatermain's Terms. So there's a format here. There's a coterie of people who do some collectively to the rest of us stupid activity. And you then place a separate observer outside it to comment on it. And in fact, for the audience to identify with. And in a very, very old interview I found in The Independent, Terry Johnson actually acknowledges this. He says there's a quite old theatrical convention of having one extremely witty character, which he says is Roseanne territory. So if you remember, again, back to that sort of 90s period of the sitcom on American television, where Roseanne Barr was the matriarch of a dysfunctional downmarket family, but she was actually acerbically witty all the time. And he says, it's bloody useful, and I've avoided it before because it seemed a bit too easy. And then when I did use it, she paradoxically became the depressed character, and all the others became the ones obsessed by comedy. It was organic, and I didn't plan it like that. So it was interesting to learn a little bit of the way he came to this structure, which I didn't read before I went to the play. And then the other thing that really struck me was I'd been more or less warned off Dead Funny by other people who'd been to see it and thought it was just like, you know, three-star revival or three-star production. And I was also had a lot of ambivalence about some of the people in it. I find Catherine Parkinson's sitcom voice extremely annoying. You know, I want her to get it fixed because I believed that was the only way she could speak. And I also have a big personal beef about Steve Pemberton because I think he can be a serious character actor, but he chooses not to be a lot of the time. So I was a bit kind of, all right, I'll go. It's a Monday night. I've nothing better to do. And then I really got into it. And I think I was about two-thirds of the way through the first act before I realised I'd actually seen it. Because this did not feel to me like the 1994 production with David Haig and Zoe Wanamaker. Possibly because Zoe Wanamaker was more predictably sophisticated than Catherine Parkinson turns out to be. And also because I think the nude scene is done in a more frontal way. I seem to remember not getting a close-up view of David Haig's personal apparatus. And if it did, I thought it was a bit like a trifle sponge. But Rufus Jones is braver about that, and modern audiences are more accepting and interested in seeing, the opening scene is where the husband and wife, Parkinson and Rufus Jones, are playing out an experimentation advised by their marital counsellor, therapist, something like that. So they're doing touch therapy, and they've got to the point at which she is allowed to touch him personally, but they mustn't let that go on to sex. And as Tim says, of course, the one thing that the husband doesn't want is for anything to cascade into sex because he's not interested in her in that way. Now, I said it was a thin Monday night audience, and it was also quite a mature audience as well. And what kept them warm, really, was the familiarity of the impersonated routines by Morecambe Wise or Frankie Howard. And also, in a kind of surreal parallel to that, the comforting him off the telly familiarity of seeing Steve Pemberton from League of Gentlemen and so much else, and perhaps Ralph Little from Two Pints of Lager and a Packet of Crisps and not much else, was their secondary reason for enjoying it. And certainly the two women behind me said, "Oh, isn't he good?" so often about Steve Pemberton, I really was in two minds whether to slap them or correct them, because he isn't. He is not good in this. He is a very talented man, a great writer, a great conceiver of dark and humorous things, but he's also sometimes quite a lazy actor. And again, another piece of research I did found turned up an old interview he did for The Guardian in 2011 when he told them this was his favourite play. So he's tasked with what seems quite easy for him. It's a play he knows and likes well. It's a surface role of a camp northern 50-year-old mother's boy, and he overdoes every aspect of the characterization until you wonder why either Terry Johnson didn't play it himself or didn't find an actually gay actor to deliver it with more conviction, because it can't all be in Boys in the Band. But for me, and for those less impressed by telly sitcom stars or sitcom standards of acting, the revelation and the absolute delight in this piece for me was Catherine Parkinson. She plays this undervalued wife whose sardonic comments and bitter analyses are what actually makes the play a sophisticated comedy. And I thought it was an inspired piece of casting. I thought her timing and subtlety and personal elegance were really impressive. And I've now completely revised my opinion of her. And she is now up there with, alongside someone like Tamsin Gregg, let's say, for her ability to cross over between hilarious TV comedy and thoughtful stage work. And I really can't pay her any higher compliment than that. I thought the structure collapsed in the second act. We have what is effectively a custard pie fight. I don't think that's giving anything away in spoiler terms, because this is a group of men who like to reenact broad music hall comedy scenes. And the descent into farce feels like an authorial escape from tidying up the strands of the plot and dealing with the actual issues of a marital breakdown. But, even in a bright green basque and pelted with trifle, Parkinson carries all before her. And no, not in the Frankie Howard or Benny Hill way. Over to Gareth, I think. Tell me why I shouldn't have liked it quite so much.
I think it's going to be very interesting combination of things here. I'll tell my Terry Johnson story first. I first saw it at Hampstead, and I obviously enjoyed it enough to go and see it again in the West End. But when I saw it in Hampstead, David Haig was indisposed. So there was a kind of natural justice that night, because Terry Johnson had to step in to play a role he wrote for a middle-aged man with a paunch to be naked, as a middle-aged man with a paunch playing naked. So I thought there was some sort of justice there that night. I think my problem with the play is that it's very much a play in two halves, and I think that I didn't actually think the first half was really funny enough. It takes quite a while to get off the ground. I mean, there aren't really very many laughs in the first sort of 15 or 20 minutes. And I felt the first half was kind of, apart from the sort of sex therapist stuff at the beginning, was kind of very light and a very light comedy and didn't really sort of have much bite to it. And then in the second half, it becomes very much darker and I thought very much better. So I think that the contrast between the two halves, I hadn't kind of remembered, to be frank, but this time round didn't seem to have the right balance for me. The second thing I found about it is it kind of dawned on me that it was very much of its time. So for me, it didn't work as well in 2016 as it did work in 1994, because we're that much further away from those kind of comedies. Secondly, I sort of felt it was very much for people of a certain age, and there were younger people in the audience who clearly weren't getting a lot of this, and also very much very, very British. And there were people in the audience, not least my Icelandic friend, who obviously missed a lot of references, because this is about the sort of television that we all actually stayed in as a family to watch on a Saturday night. And it really is, it's a kind of golden age of comedy, where, you know, you had Morecambe and Wise pulling in 28 million people, for goodness sake, on a Saturday night show, or perhaps it was a Christmas special. So I see the play very much as a homage to that kind of classic British comedy period, which I don't think we have anymore. I think it's all kind of scattered and become very much more diverse, really. So I think that I enjoyed the play, but I kind of went thinking it might be a classic, but I came away thinking, well, no, it isn't really a classic. But I was glad I went back to see it again. I think that one of the other problems for me is that quite recently, James Graham, who's a very, very good young playwright, wrote a play called Monster Raving Loony, which only had a fringe run in London at the Soho Theatre. And even though the play is about a politician, albeit a comic politician in Screaming Lord Sutch, actually, the way it's produced is it's done as a series of sketches and routines and films from absolutely every British comedy you ever remember, and actually is a better homage and a much funnier homage to British comedy than this is. So the juxtaposition of my seeing that and this probably didn't help. So that plus the non-British companion plus the first and second half made me enjoy it less, I think, than you did. Having said all of that, I'm a completely echo what you say about Catherine Parkinson. I've never really been a big fan of Catherine Parkinson, but I really do think she pulls off something very clever here, which is to play against the flow of the play, because every other character is a very committed member of this society and she isn't, because her marriage is struggling, because she's desperate for a baby, and all of these things make her character play against the comedy of the other characters, and I think she does that remarkably well. I didn't really know the work of Rufus Jones, to be honest. I'm not sure I've ever seen him on stage before. And I was quite impressed by him as well. I thought I'm not very familiar with his work, but I think what he has to pull off, he has to make it believable that a surgeon would also like Benny Hill. And perhaps that's very disparaging of me. I think he's very, very good as well, really. I didn't feel as strongly about Steve Pemberton, but I do recall Niall Buggy in the original production being very, very good. I wasn't sure about Ralph Little, to be honest. And by the way, his probably more famous role was in The Royal Family rather than Packets of Crisps or whatever it was called. But I did think Emily Barrington, and I'm wondering whether she's related to Elizabeth Barrington, but I did think Emily Barrington was very good as Lisa, Ralph Little's wife. So, I mean, an enjoyable evening, but not the classic I thought it could be, but a good production nonetheless. I just wish he maybe had revisited the play and sort of looked at the two halves and maybe did a bit of rewriting. It might have helped. What did you think, Tim?
There is a fundamental problem why Terry Johnson can't rewrite this, because if he did, he might have to deal with his historical howlers. He's very big on his historical howlers, though, Terry Johnson. I think in Hysteria, which is about Freud, he admits that the meeting between Freud and Dali almost certainly didn't happen, or it did happen, but it was nowhere near as interesting as the play is. Hitchcock Blonde, which is his play about Alfred Hitchcock, is so inaccurate that, I mean, he basically acts as if Hitchcock made a snuff film in 1919 and fled to America. So it sort of basically writes out his entire silent film career in Britain and films like The Secret Agent and 39 Steps. So yeah, Terry Johnson doesn't care about history, and there is a major howler in this play. Basically, we have the deaths of two people. We have Benny Hill and we have Frankie Howard. At the beginning of the play, they are commemorating Benny Hill's death, which happened on the 20th of April 1992, although he wasn't discovered until 2 days later. And then somebody has a vision of Frankie Howard dying because the character of Lisa thinks that she is psychic in some way. Well, she wouldn't exactly need to be psychic because Frankie Howard died on the 19th of April, 1992. So 3 days before Benny Hill was discovered, essentially, and the day before Benny Hill actually died. There is a rather unfortunate thing where when somebody famous dies, you would get other famous people to leave quotes. These days it's all done by Twitter. But in old days, you would probably release a quote via your agent, and Benny Hill's agent released a quote without actually talking to Benny Hill. And so the headline was, Benny Hill pays his respects to Frankie Howard. This is a problem at the centre of the play, and it does put you off if you know the Howlers. I think when you deal with Terry Johnson, it's probably best to accept that he's just going to change history to make the story funnier, because I don't think it would have worked quite as well if he had done Frankie Howard first and then Benny Hill second as the deaths. There's a certain amount of, ooh, madam, that you can do with Frankie Howard, and that's about it. There's a lot more stuff you can do with Benny Hill's, you know, his characterizations, which of course these days look appalling. Bad Chinese people constantly running around, but at least you've got clear characters there. The problem, of course, is that nobody's seen any Benny Hill for 20 years or something like that. He has almost completely disappeared from our televisions, so we don't get the sense of it that we would have just about got 2 years after he died, which is when the play was put on. But even then, he had gone out of fashion quite a lot. It has to be said, though, that Frankie Howard was making another one of his comebacks, as John said. I actually saw him, I think in 1990, doing his stand-up routine at the Lyric Hammersmith, and on that night I was surrounded by young comedians who were all sort of worshipping the throne of Frankie Howard. Although it has to be said that Frankie Howard in his personal life was extremely unpleasant. There are stories of him pushing people against a wall and feeling them up. He was rather unpleasant like that, and he was homosexual, and he was usually pushing men up against a wall and feeling them up, which some people really did not enjoy, and sometimes had to go on, introduce him, and pretend that they were his best friend afterwards. So he's not he wasn't a nice character, and that's probably a difficulty now that we see with these people, and that's how we tend to remember them, rather than remembering their comedy, because we don't get enough of their comedy coming out of it. I mean, Frankie Howard, I always go back to the Up the movies that he did, Up Pompeii, Up the Chastity Belt, and Up the Front he did in the early 70s, which are very typical early 70s comedies. I think all directed by Ned Sherrin, and are extremely entertaining, but they are of their time. As you both of you said, there is this problem of it being of its time. If you go into this theatre with a lot of people who are probably over 45 and all British and all remember seeing these things on television, then you're probably going to have an audience that is warm and receptive to a lot of the antics in this play. But if you're going with people who are not from this country, or at least not from America, where they worship Benny Hill, but if you're going to people from other parts of the world, they just won't get any of the nuances, any of the comedy, any of the voices. They just won't understand them. And even a young British audience isn't going to understand them. I think I was in a young British audience, and they were trying to like it, because they do fire off the jokes quite well, and the cast were good at putting in the jokes. They just kept going over everybody's head, and the audience, they wanted to like what they were seeing, but I don't think they really enjoyed it. And I've got questions. As I said, I have certain attitudes on Frank Howard and Benny Hill, and I know the story of the historical Howlers, so I came in this with a bit of a cynical attitude. And I think, though, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. I mean, I'm not like everybody else, I'm not a big fan of Kathryn Parkinson, although I've seen her do, you know, dramatic roles, and she's been rather good in those. But yes, there is this sort of, I really don't enjoy women constantly having to be that sour, humourless person. And although it might be an interesting revelation, I kind of want her to be having a lot more fun. And I don't think an awful lot of the plays I see her in, she's not being the fun. She's being the sad, or the cynical, or the put upon. And I don't really want to see her doing that. I would like to see her much more forceful and active.
Terry Johnson does like to bring in historical characters or reference real people in his plays. He's done that many, many times. But it doesn't really bother me that much if he uses that as a device and it isn't sort of literally exactly accurate, really. So I just think it's something he does. So that I therefore don't get bothered by that kind of stuff, really.
We're now going to talk about The Children at the Royal Court Theatre. This is a play by Lucy Kirkwood, who gave us Chimerica and NSFW. It's directed by James MacDonald and stars Francesca Annis, Ron Cook and Deborah Findlay. The basic setting of the play is we are in a cottage which is a safe distance away from a plant. It's implied that it's a nuclear plant, and we have a couple of retired nuclear scientists, Robin and Hazel, Ron Cook and Deborah Findlay, and they are living a quiet life, sort of a life of retirement, a life where they're trying to talk to their children, their grandchildren, and into their world comes Rose, played by Francesca Annis, and she brings up the past, their past at this plant where they all used to work, and also the past relationships that they have had, and maybe how Robin and Hazel got together, and how Rose may have played a part in their lives. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
I have to say I was captivated by this play from beginning to end. The part of that could be because I've liked most of the things I've seen Lucy Kirkwood do. Well, actually, that's just two plays. But also partly because I think it's very much a play for my age group. Because it's, as you say, it's these sort of 60-something retired nuclear scientists who've now retired to their smallholding, you know, dairy smallholding. They've temporarily moved away because there has been an incident. The smallholding is close to the plant. And we explore, really, their sort of working past through the arrival of a former colleague who seems to spend most of her time in the US, who's, unlike them, has never married and doesn't have children. They have four children and four grandchildren, the four children grown up and away from home. At first, we were just exploring, you know, how they knew each other and what they did together and mutual friends and somewhat more complex relationships. But then we also explore things around energy policy and environmental factors. And so it becomes a many, many layered play. And it's also, I think, about generational legacy. It's about, you know, what one generation leaves to another and their responsibilities with that. It's about growing old. It's about relationships. It's got so many things going for it. And I just thought it was very rich in narrative, really, and it didn't lose me for 1 minute in the whole of the sort of unbroken 2 hours, really. I think it's helped by a very clever design by Miriam Huerta, which isn't a radical design in many ways because it's just a cottage kitchen. But the way she does it, it's kind of very closed in by the walls and the floor and the ceiling. So it does give it a lot more intimacy, particularly, I think, if you're sitting in the stalls. You do feel as if you're peering into not just the room, but also peering into the lives. And I felt it really did add something to the play. I did think that all three performances, Deborah Findlay, who was still having one or two problems with the lines on the night I went, but it didn't bother. Deborah Findlay, Francesca Annis and Ron Cook are all, I thought, all excellent. And they put over both complexity of the past and the current dilemma that they have very believably. And I think, you know, James MacDonald is a good director, and I think he does direct this very beautifully, really. Great, sort of very delicate. Can't sort of see the director's hand, really, which is probably a sign of a good piece of work. So I really, really liked it. I mean, I thought Chimerica was one of the best plays in the year it came out, and I think this is one of the best plays in the year it came out. I mean, I think it'll feature in my best plays of this year. She does seem to me to be a very distinctive modern voice in theatre, because I think Chimerica was more epic, but it was also a sort of rich theatrical feast in the same way as this is. And I'm looking forward to a new play next year at the National that she's doing. So there'll be another new play next year for us to see, because I do think she's positioning herself in quite a unique place. You know, there are other great modern playwrights and other great female modern playwrights, but she's sort of got this niche, which I think is quite unique. And I think you know, seeing this after Chimerica kind of proves that point, really. I was a little bit worried that, you know, Chimerica was a very hard thing to follow, but, you know, I think she's done something very different, but something just as rewarding. Since I've been out of the theatre, I've been recommending this to a lot of people, particularly people of my age, and suggested they go and see it because I think it's a great piece of work. What did you think, Tim?
I wasn't quite so charmed as you were by this play, at least initially. I found there are little bits. It's to do with a pettiness. I mean, there's a certain pettiness in some of the things that happen, you know, things like the toilet getting blocked and stuff like that. And there's things that are ordinary, and then perhaps you can argue that they are realistic and they are the way that, you know, people who don't really like each other are being petty towards each other. But I just didn't get on with that, certainly initially. I think once you get the deeper picture, and we've agreed not to go into too much detail about exactly what the circumstances are behind Rose's visit. We'll leave that as a mystery for people to work out, although if you widely read the reviews, I think you will find a lot more clues to that. But I think I liked it after this mystery was cleared up, and when they really get into why Rose is there, it became a much more interesting play. When it was just a distant visitor who was appeared to be just visiting for the hell of it, or for just for old times, that didn't work for me quite as well, because I didn't really like the smallness of that idea, I think, and the pettiness and the point scoring. It made me feel uncomfortable, and this certainly is the initial part of the play. But when we get into the whole much more developing into the past and what much more about what is going to happen. It's also when it came to the idea of the children, you don't really get a picture of the children or of the children's value, at least not, again, not initially. You are sitting there thinking, why is this play called The Children? They don't really feature. I mean, there is only, I think, one child who has any form of character in this play. I mean, they are all obviously off-stage characters, but there's only one you get a good picture of. And even her, I didn't think she was clearly drawn enough for me. If you're going to talk about their importance, and I mean, you know, you call a play the children should be important and should be in a way central, and although things we can't talk about do make the children important, do make the children kind of central, I would have liked to have had a better idea of their relationship to their children, and you know, a more complex idea of their relationship to their children before the revelation of why that sort of thing is important. And I think that let me down in a way, thinking about this play. I mean, obviously, you've got quality on the stage in terms of the acting and the direction and the set, and also Lucy Kirkwood is showing herself to be a very skillful writer, but I did have problems. And also, because we've agreed not to talk about the circumstance, I can't say why I think that thing is handled rather heavy-handedly.
Can I just add, though, that I think that the reason it's called The Children is not in any way referencing their children. I think the fact that Robin and Hazel have children and grandchildren is an important fact, but they are an irrelevance because The Children refers generically to our children's children, if you see what I mean. In other words, it's about the legacy that we leave for our children. So I think the actual children are frankly irrelevant. I therefore saw it very differently to you in that sense.
We're now going to talk about Kiss Me, which is downstairs at the Hampstead Theatre. This is a space where they don't open it for formal reviews, so you never see newspaper reviews of plays downstairs at the Hampstead. The idea is that these are tryouts, and they've had one or two plays transfer out of downstairs, upstairs into the main room. I think they've had a couple up that have gone upstairs, and one or two have even gone into the West End, either straight from downstairs or via the Hampstead. Kiss Me is written by Richard Bean, directed by Anna Ledwidge, with the design by Georgia Lowe. It is quite an interesting thing because Richard Bean is very much a playwright who's had a lot of success and a lot of high profile recently. His most recent large play was The Nap up in Sheffield, which starred Jack O'Connell, and we are rather hoping that this will transfer. Of course, The Nap was a play about snooker, and it was done in the home of, I can never remember if it's the World Championships or the UK Championships, but it is, the Crucible is a major venue for snooker in the country, and this is a play about snooker. Richard Bean, he occasionally goes back into historical plays like Harvest, and to a certain extent Under the Whaleback, are plays that look back at history. And this is a short play that he has picked up on, where we have two people who are meeting. One is a war widow and the other is a young handsome man whose job it is to impregnate them. It's a formalized thing. There's a doctor behind it who they refer to, and it's supposed to be a very impersonal thing. You know, it is insemination. It is something that might be done by other means these days, in a much more impersonal way, and they try to keep it impersonal, but it doesn't entirely work. So we have two characters. One is Stephanie, who is a war widow, played by Claire Lambs, and Dennis, a young man who is doing the service, as you might say, at the end of the First World War. We are in the 1920s, so they are both scarred by the First World War in different ways. She has lost her husband and wants a child, and he is keeping rather too many secrets. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I think first talk about Richard Bean, because Richard Bean has become one of my very favourite playwrights in recent years. And I think what's interesting about him is, first of all, he didn't really start his playwriting career until he was about 40, which is very late, I think, for a playwright. We've just been talking about Lucy Kirkwood, who's still in her 20s, I think, or perhaps early 30s. But he certainly made up for that, because he's written, if we count his book for a musical, Maid in Dagenham, and the two adaptations he did, I mean, he has written 23 plays already, which is in well under 20 years, I think. So that's significant. The second thing is his diversity. I mean, if you look at his plays, it's an incredible diversity of subject, and it's an incredible diversity of style. And this is, again, something different for Richard Bean, despite the fact it's number 23. I think the other feature of his output is its quality. I think he does write really well. Particularly, he writes humour very well, but I actually think this one, I mean, it's got humour in it, but it's a more serious subject. It's just a short play, but it's, for me, it's a kind of a little gem, really. As you say, it's set soon after the First World War, so it's a kind of period piece, and this man is sent by a doctor, and that's what he does. It's something he does for women like her, and indeed also for the wives of the war wounded as well, we learn. And I think it's also interesting because he wasn't in the war. And I think that's sort of part of it, really. He's kind of doing his bit, perhaps, in a rather different way. And although they exchange pleasantries, they don't even use their real names. They're not supposed to know anything about each other. So the parameters that are established by the doctor are sort of strictly business, as it were. And in this particular case, she can't go through with it, and they part. But because something's left behind, they do get to meet again. And then another relationship that isn't instigated by the doctor begins to start. I mean, Richard Bean has quite drawing power now, and it's in a way surprising to see why, you know, that this is in a small space like the Hampstead Theatre downstairs for a small run. But actually, when you see the play, you do see why, because it does need the intimacy that the Hampstead Theatre downstairs actually gives it. And they stage it here with the audience on two sides. And it is just a bedroom, and you are very much, you know, sort of peering into this bedroom. I thought it was a beautifully written piece. And I thought, given it's only 70 minutes long, I thought it had an incredible depth of characterization, really. I mean, I think you really did get to know and understand these two people, perhaps because there are only two characters. And it does, you know, often surprise you. There is humour, but it's a gentle, kind of very warm humour, which is very much in keeping with the more serious subject matter. So I thought it was a lovely piece of writing. I thought Anna Ledwich directed it very sensitive to the material. And he's sensitive to the audience, because of the audience on two sides, the way she sort of dealt with the business, as it were. And I thought the two performances by Claire Lambs and Ben Lloyd Hughes were absolutely delightful. They sort of conveyed the repression that you would have had in that period, but also the intimacy of the relationship that they eventually had. So I really enjoyed going to this. And I don't always go to the theatre downstairs, I have to say. I go upstairs more often because I'm a bit more risk averse. And most of the things you have downstairs tend to be by less known playwrights. But I was really glad I went to this, because I thought it was a lovely little treat. What did you think?
It is a treat to see a Richard Bean play. As I said, we're looking forward to the nap. I think I've seen 18 of his plays now, which is not bad for, you know, missing out about five of them. So he is a playwright who I've always admired, and even some of his more difficult stuff. I mean, something like Harvest, which is set around the same time and was extremely long. It works. He's certainly a good writer. This does look like he's trying something out, and we might. I wonder if we will get a better, you know, a longer play, a more detailed play out of this, or whether this will, you know, transfer somewhere else or be tried out somewhere else. It's certainly very promising and very affecting, and it worked for me. It worked extremely well. Thing about the Hampstead Theatre downstairs is it's always worth taking a punt on. The seats are kept very cheap, and it is something that is very experimental, but I would always recommend it. I think it is one of the best new writing spaces around. Maybe not, it's not as controversial as other new writing places or ones that want to be fierce, but they get good people to do good work, and it's always worth giving anything that's in there a bit of a go. I mean, you're not always going to see quality work, but sometimes you do see plays which are amazing, and if you miss them, it's almost like they're gone forever. There has been some very interesting work down there.
I think the one exception for downstairs that I can remember, I mean, I think they've had more than one transfer in, but the big transfer was Diane Vim Rose, which went upstairs and then subsequently went into the West End. So, you know, big things have started here. There have been transfers, I think, to the Trafalgar Studios from here. But it's an interesting concept to sort of, you know, to have this small theatre putting on work and then not, you know, not having press reviews. And I think in a way, maybe that kind of allows it to breathe. But it does mean that if you haven't kind of booked, just taken the punt, as it were, then you probably don't get to see things because you won't be waiting for reviews because there won't be any.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.